The third case for oral argument this morning is Citibank versus Tonette L. Hoff. Citibank is represented by Roberto Lang, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and the appellee, Tonette Hoff, is represented by Robert Kaczynski, an attorney from Rapid City. We have a disqualification in this case. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Tim Johns, a circuit judge from the 4th Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Mr. Lang, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, and law clerks. The circuit court grant of summary judgment for defendant Hoff Schauer on Citibank's complaint cannot stand under the law or the facts of this case. In September of 1996, Hoff Schauer applied for a Citibank Choice Gold credit card. In the application, she asked that David Hoff, her then husband, be added as an authorized user on the account and also have a second credit card on the account issued in his name. Citibank accommodated that request. The relationship between Hoff Schauer and Citibank on her account is governed by the Citibank card agreement. The card agreement makes clear under the additional card section that someone like Hoff Schauer may permit another person to have access to the card, which she did, and access to the account number, which she did in David Hoff. The card agreement goes on to say, you must notify us to revoke permission for any person you previously authorized for use of your account. It's undisputed that Hoff Schauer never notified Citibank to revoke the authority of David Hoff to use the account and to access the account. Not until after the charges at issue were made did Hoff Schauer notify Citibank that she no longer wanted the account. That was in May of 1999, after the charges at issue were made. Under additional cards, the card agreement also makes clear that Hoff Schauer is responsible for the use of each card on the account according to the terms, including for charges that she may not have intended to be responsible when made by David Hoff. Hoff Schauer, when she opened the account, gave as her address 5301 Solitaire Drive in Rapid City, which was the marital residence. Hoff Schauer had the obligation under the credit card agreement, and this is at addendum 4 to the appellant's brief, quote, you must notify us of a change in your address by contacting customer service by telephone or mail. It is clear that Hoff Schauer never contacted Citibank to advise that she was getting a divorce from David Hoff and moving out of 5301 Solitaire Drive until May of 1999, after the charges at issue were made. The card agreement also contains a section on closing your account, which is at addendum page 6. This section makes clear that the account relationship doesn't terminate when the initial term for the plastics expires and new plastics are issued, but rather the account continues until either the cardholder notifies Citibank in writing, which Tonette Hoff Schauer never did, of an intent to terminate the account, or until Citibank chooses to suspend or terminate the account. Closing your account also makes clear that Citibank may reissue a different card, as in a renewal card, which is industry standard and occurred here after the initial two-year term. Hoff Schauer did not notify Citibank of an intent to close the account.
Excuse me, on that, on back up to just to what you had said about issuing a new card. When I read that sentence, though, it sounds as if they're reissuing a different card, different account number, or different checks. So that would not apply necessarily to reissuing of the same account, a card on the same account at the end of the year when the card expires.
I would disagree respectfully with that reading. It says we may also reissue
But then it says...
When a card is initially issued, it's not a reissuance, it's a new card. It's an issuance of a card. Reissue refers to the renewal card. A different card, it is a different card, it has a different expiration date, but obviously has the same account number on it and is a continuation of the line of credit of the open account relationship that exists from the outset. So this language in referring to reissue is referencing renewal cards, which is what happened here. After Hoff Schauer moved out of the residence without notifying Citibank, without giving them a new address, and after, and without having notified Citibank that she intended to revoke the authority of David Hoff to use the card, Citibank did send renewal cards, as is industry practice, as is contemplated by TILA, and as permitted, I believe, under South Dakota law as well, which David Hoff received, called from the marital residence to acknowledge receipt of the card and then began using. This is a case where Hofschauer could have done one of three things. She could have notified Citibank that she was closing the account. And there is some question of fact on the effect of a call that she made in May of 1998, but that's a question of fact for a jury. She could have notified Citibank of an address change, which is her obligation when she moves, and she didn't do that. She could have called Citibank to revoke the authority of David Hoff to authorize to use the account, which she did not do. Under these circumstances, at a minimum, there's a jury question of whether David Hoff continued to be an authorized user, as under TILA and the cardholder agreement.
Is there anything in the contract dealing with who may validate a renewal card or a reissued card?
There's nothing that expressly addresses who may acknowledge receipt of a reissued card, because it's a security measure and not something that is called out by TILA or any other law to be addressed in a cardholder agreement.
Well, it's more than acknowledging receipt. I mean, Citibank wouldn't allow somebody to charge on an expired card. It's a reactivation.
It is an acknowledgement, and it is also an activation process, I understand. These are security-type measures. There's generally different data that can be on the swipe of the card. Yes, Citibank does require that somebody call, and in this case it was from Merida residence, and pass through security, which David Hoff was able to do. We think it was the mother's maiden name that was the security code on Tanette Hoff's account, and identified himself as a person who had access to the card, indeed had a card himself, and was able to activate it in that way.
If you could finish Justice Cunningham's question, was there this reactivation? Is there something in the agreement that allows a mere authorized user to reactivate a card?
I believe that it is addressed indirectly. There's nothing, Mr. Justice Zinter, that addresses it directly. That is true.
So under what legal theory, then, does he have the authority to do so? Isn't he just a third-party beneficiary of this contract? He's not a contracting party. He's allowed to enjoy the benefits of it as a third-party beneficiary under a contract theory. So
well,
what's the legal authority for him to do so?
For start, Dahl versus Sittner, which talks as to apparent and ostensible authority. And TILA and Reg Z section 226.12b1, which talks about what is an authorized user on a credit card. TILA adopts common law theories of authority, apparent and implied and ostensible authority, engaging who is an authorized user of a credit card. And in this case, David Hoff was an authorized user of the card from the outset, had a card issued to him at Hofschauer's request, was added with access to the account by Hofschauer, and Citibank was not notified differently at any point until May of 1999.
Where in the agreement does it appear as though he's appointed an agent?
Well, under additional cars, Your Honor, it says you may permit another person to have access to the card or account number, which she did. However, if you do so, you must pay for all charges made by those persons, including charges for which you may not have intended to be responsible. There's nothing in that language that lops off that responsibility after the initial time period of the cards.
Well, you know, you indicate there's nothing expressed in the agreement. From reading the transcript, it appears like there's also implied exceptions that your witness acknowledged. For instance, I see that they distinguish between the primary account holder and a user in two ways. They say that they wouldn't allow a mere user to increase the credit line or to change the PIN number, or there's even testimony that once the account was closed, he answers that they could not open the account or reactivate it. So apparently there are implied distinctions that are drawn by Citibank with respect to authority of mere users versus the account holder.
There are, and there's nothing that requires, and indeed it'd be unworkable, to put all of these sort of policies and procedures into a cardholder agreement. But it is true that once the account is terminated, which never occurred here, once the account is terminated, the authorized user or secondary user cannot reopen it. And what you did mention is true, the secondary user cannot procure an increase in the credit line or a change in a PIN number. However,
Well, if they can't do those things, why should they reactivate? How could they reactivate somebody else's account?
Your Honor, I think it's important to understand that this is not a new account. This isn't reactivating a closed account. This is a line of credit. This is an open account under the same account number that existed from September of 96 when Hofschauer opened it and authorized David Hoff on the account through until May of 1999 after the charges at issue were made when she closed the account. It isn't a change, it isn't a termination and then restarting of the account. And I believe as the court looks at TILA, and I think with the experience we all have, I assume, as credit card users, we know that every 2 years or so, the credit card company sends us new cards. This is done throughout the United States, I understand. It'd be very curious for South Dakota, I believe, to become the first state that would require a cardholder to physically call in and request that a new card be sent, and indeed, I think the citizenry would be rather surprised when no renewal card came and they found themselves with a terminated account or a card that didn't work because it had expired.
But on the other hand, if David had not been permitted to reactivate this card and had charged these things on an expired card, we wouldn't be here today. I mean, I don't think Citibank would even have brought this case had he run up these charges on an expired card.
I believe your assumption is correct, although under TILA, I think she, Hofschauer would still possibly be responsible for $50, and that appears in the credit card agreement, and is a worthy point under any circumstances. There's a question under TILA, even if this is an unauthorized use, as to her responsibility for $50, because section, I think it's 15 U.S.C. 1643A1 applies here as a limitation, even if it wasn't authorized. And under these circumstances, at a minimum, there's a jury question of his authorization to use this account and whether Citibank had any notion that that authorization changed at any point before May of 1999. Indeed, the record would indicate it did not.
Would you address the federal law and regulation and how it preempts, or how it applies in this case?
Okay. Yes. 15 U.S.C. Section 1642 is part of TILA and says that no credit card shall be issued except in response to a request or application. Therefore, quote, this prohibition does not apply to the issuance of a credit card in renewal of or in substitution for an accepted card, end quote. Section 226.28 of Reg Z makes this preemptive, saying that any inconsistent or contradictory state law is to be displaced. The Bank of America case from the Ninth Circuit and more closely on point, the Transamerica case from the North Dakota Supreme Court, both cited in our brief, indicates that TILA is preemptive of inconsistent state regulations. One of the misapprehensions of the circuit court was that 54.11.4 stood in the way of a credit card issuing company issuing renewal cards. That's I believe a misunderstanding, misapplication of 54.11.4. 54.11.4 tracks closely some of the TILA language and is a prohibition on sending unsolicited cards or issuing unsolicited cards. In this case, in September of 96, Hofschauer requested, solicited the credit card for both herself and for her then husband, David Hoff. The Locke case and some of the other cases I cited talk about federal preemption generally. It applies when there's an express preemption, which there actually is here, or when the regulations so fill the area that it leaves little for the state to do. And I'd submit Reg Z and TILA and banking law in the credit card area is just that sort of regulation. I want to briefly turn to the last two sections of the brief, starting with the third issue, which is Baratree. The Baratree statute, both sides cite Ridley, a decision from this court from 2000 that speaks to what is a frivolous case. There's a contention that Citibank's complaint, and indeed the arguments I've been making, are frivolous. Under Ridley, a frivolous case is one that where a proponent can present no rational argument based on evidence or law, where it's so deficient that no reasonable person could expect a favorable ruling.
Can I interrupt you just for a moment on this issue? Did the trial court make a ruling on those, or did the court simply reserve ruling on those questions?
The court denied Citibank's motion for partial summary judgment on the counterclaim.
All right, so they are and, properly before us then.
Yes, and certified the entire ruling. And the frivolous prohibition or the malicious filing prohibition doesn't apply to a case like this one where there's a genuine dispute, a disagreement over the facts, over what the law should be. I certainly hope my argument doesn't drop to the level of being irrational, unreasonable, ridiculous, and implausible, which is the sort of description that Ridley gives for what is a frivolous or malicious case. So in reversing the grant of summary judgment on the complaint, as this court should, the court should also direct the trial court to enter summary judgment on the Baratree claim. Indeed, if summary judgment doesn't apply to the Baratree claim here, it opens up, I think, Pandora's box of one side claiming the other claim is Baratree and then getting a claim back that, gee, no, your Baratree claim is Baratree. And I don't think that serves any function. Indeed, is a misservice to our court system. Finally, there is an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. This court has recognized that it is a matter of law for the court to determine initially if the defendant's conduct can be regarded as so extreme and outrageous as to permit a recovery. And there's a list of cases where this court has affirmed summary judgment on such claims. Here, the collection notes, which are attached to the brief, contain a history of the collection contacts. Hofschauer considers these to be ones that made her feel like a criminal, where there was yelling and garnishment threatened. The decisions of this court indicate that insults, indignities, threats, annoyances, and so forth are are not enough to be extreme and outrageous and justify such a claim. Rather, the cases that this court has permitted on intentional infliction of emotional distress typically contain some prurient element where the parties know each other or somebody's acting in an over-the-top fashion, like the Rupel case with the obscene phone calls that Poff Schauer cites. There is an absence of any evidence of intent on the part of Citibank to cause emotional distress. Citibank's trying to collect a $9,200 obligation, money that it paid out to a merchant bank and in turn went to merchants where these charges were made. They're not trying to inflict distress. The Wade case from the Eastern District of Missouri, which contains the same elements of the tort as ours, is a collection case which did grant summary judgment, and I think this court should do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Gazinski, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. The one thing that I think all the parties in this case agree on is that the credit card agreement in this particular case governs the relationship between the parties. Nothing in TILA, which is the federal law, or the state law, prohibits the parties from contracting under terms which they choose to contract under. And I think it is important, and this court has alluded to it, that one examine exactly what rights a secondary card member or an authorized user gets, and it's not rights to the accounts, as was alluded by Justice Inter. There are some restrictions, but specifically on the additional card section in the credit card agreement, the very first sentence set forth what an authorized card user has access to. And it states, you may request additional cards on your account for yourself or others, and you may permit another person to have access to the card or account number. And that's an important distinction in this case because an authorized user cannot do anything without the card and a card that has been properly activated. And I think in this case, the whole issue is whether the secondary card member, in this case, David Hoff, had any right or any authority under the credit card agreement to activate a card. And the answer there was asked by this court, was asked by the trial court, where in the credit card agreement is there any authority for a secondary card member to activate a card? And the answer was, well, there really isn't, but it's implied or you can read into it. Well, the problem with that is that the law governing credit card agreements states that credit card agreements are just like insurance contracts. They are to be narrowly construed. And any doubtful issues ought to be resolved against the issuer of the credit card. I'm not saying, and neither is Hoff, Tonette Hoff Schauer is not alleging that there's any ambiguity in the credit card agreement. There isn't. There just simply is no authority for a secondary card member to activate a card. And I think
there is, however, responsibility of the card holder to make sure that account is either closed, and in this case where she was clearly aware that he was using that card, and that was the agreement between them. You know, where are her responsibilities? How can we excuse her responsibilities as well?
Thank you, Justice Meyer-Henry. The answer to that is that, as Mr. Lang alluded already, there is a dispute whether the account had actually been closed. Tonette Hoff Schauer and Citibank's own collection records indicate that she had called and she stated that she wanted the account closed. And this was before any of the charges were incurred. The difference in the factual scenarios between the parties is that Citibank's collection notes reflect a statement that she was directed to a customer service representative as opposed to a collection agent to close her account. Tonette Hoff Schauer states she was never told that because if she would have been told that, she would have closed the account. After all, she already said once that she wanted the account closed. So with respect to your question, Justice Meyer-Henry, Tonette Hoff Schauer undertook the responsibility which she had by asking that the account was closed. Now,
that's not what the lower court based their decision on.
No, and that's absolutely right, Your Honor. And the reason the lower court didn't base its decision on it because there is a dispute of fact and it couldn't be adjudicated by way of summary judgment. For the purpose of our summary judgment motion, the question is, does a secondary cardholder under this credit card agreement have any authority to activate a card? And there's absolutely no authority in this agreement that would allow a secondary card member to activate the card. In fact, there's additional language. And in fact, the responsibility that is placed on the primary account holder is such that it states, you are responsible for the use of each card issued in your account according to the terms of the agreement. Now, how can Citibank possibly expect that a primary cardholder or a primary holder of an account can be responsible for each card if that primary member has absolutely no way to control whether or not that card is received, whether or not that card is activated? And the facts are such that the cards are not mailed to the secondary cardholder. The cards are mailed to the primary cardholder, which was Tonette Hofschauer. It was through the thievery of her ex-husband that the envelope was opened and the card was activated. And I think there's further evidence as to the way that Citibank treats this responsibility in Citibank's own collection notes, which are attached as an addendum to appellant's brief. And specifically, the addendum is, pages 7 through 10 of appellant's brief. And if one reads to the addendum, there is a distinct difference between the way that Citibank characterizes the card member, which would be Tonette Hofschauer. That card member is labeled as CM for card member, and the secondary card member, who is labeled as an SCNM. Well, on page 10 of the addendum, Citibank's own collection notes, or customer service notes, I should say, I apologize, the 11-8-98 notes state, received call from CM, which is card member, which would have been Tonette Hofschauer. Verified cards received, early warning process completed. Citibank got it wrong. Tonette Hofschauer never called. It was David Hoff that called, but yet Citibank labeled him as the card member in this particular case. I think there's, it really is clear, I think, from the credit card agreement and such things as the collection notes, that in order for the card member to be responsible for each card, that card member has got to have some ability to either activate or not activate the card and somehow rely on the expiration dates of cards given to others.
So in this case, Citibank would not be able to collect the amounts that were charged on that card.
Correct. And I, my
they couldn't collect directly from David.
Oh, they could. I think they could, because under the theories of fraud and conversion, Your Honor, because David had no right to activate the card. But even though he activated the card and charged the amounts, there's no dispute by either party here that David truly is the party after whom Citibank should have gone after. In this particular case, they didn't even name him as a party. We third-partied him and obtained the default judgment against Mr. David Hoff because he never answered the complaint. I do want to touch briefly on what Justice Connenkamp brought up, and that is the what did the lower court do with respect to the summary judgment motions on intentional infliction of emotional distress and barratry. And Justice Connenkamp is absolutely correct that at the hearing, the trial court held those matters in abeyance. And the trial court's reasoning was that, you know, there's a difference between trying to collect from someone who really truly owes the money. That person ought not to be so sensitive to collection efforts undertaken by banks, as opposed to a person who absolutely does not owe the amount and shouldn't have to pay it. And therefore, the judge really, he held it in abeyance, and that's reflected on page 52 of the hearing transcript. And essentially, the sentence that is important there is about mid-page. Because of that, the question on the Barrett reaction and the emotional distress will be had in abeyance. Now, I will admit that the court's order that was signed did deny those motions, but I think it is clear, at least from the hearing transcript, that the trial court did not consider those issues until it had an opportunity to determine whether or not Citibank truly had the right to collect from Tonette Hoff.
Did you fully argue, though, to the trial court, the elements of intentional infliction and baratry and whether the affidavits and facts as developed at the summary judgment stage either supported or failed to support those claims?
Yes, Your Honor, that was done.
So it was fully argued to the trial court?
It was fully argued. The court had in front of it all briefs, affidavits, deposition transcript in support or against those summary judgment motions. It was fully argued at oral argument at the hearing. And essentially what the court said is that it will hold it in abeyance because if Tonette Hoff Schauer truly was not the party that Citibank should have sued or made those collection calls to, then the court believed that Citibank's summary judgment motions on both baratry and intentional infliction of emotional distress would have to be denied.
Let me ask the next obvious question then. If you did fully argue it, and we review those de novo in any event, why should we not go ahead and make the decision on all three issues, rather than sending it back to the trial court to decide it?
Your Honor, I didn't, you know, actually, I'm not making an argument that this court shouldn't decide it. I was trying to answer the court's concern as to what the trial court did down below. I fully understand that the trial court had in front of it all of it, and that it did, the order that it ultimately signed did deny Citibank's summary judgment.
You don't oppose our going ahead and deciding those issues since there's nothing more that would go into the record?
I do not, Your Honor. No. I was just, and I apologize if I made it confusing. I was just simply trying to clarify what the court below did and what the court's thinking below was. With respect to the baratry claim, frivolousness is not the only element of a baratry claim. It could be an action of defense that is brought in bad faith. In this particular case, Tonette Hoff Schauer maintains that Citibank had in front of it all information necessary to deduce, or at least to conduct an investigation into Tonette Hoff Schauer's claims. In fact, the interesting part about this case is that when Tonette Hoff Schauer first found out about these charges that were made approximately, well, slightly less than a year after those charges had started to be incurred, she asked the person from Citibank that called her to produce the statements to her. She had no idea as to what was going on. And that Citibank customer service representative, before the initiation of any lawsuit in this case, before anything had advanced, produced to her all the statements. And the statements showed that immediately after the Black Hills Federal Credit Union check to pay off the credit card debt was mailed, the next statement showed that the credit balance was zero, that the, I want to make sure I get the wording correct, that the total credit line was zero, that the available credit line is zero, that the cash advance limit is zero, and that the available cash line is zero. There's also a code on that statement to indicate how many plastics, how many cards are issued in the account, and those showed zero as well. So Citibank, before any litigation commenced, produced to Tonette Hoff at least internal documents that would seem to indicate that the account was truly closed, which is exactly what, you know, what Tonette Hoff's issue is in this case, that she initially did close the account. Well, once litigation commenced, Tonette Hoff Schauer asked for all statements relating to the account. All statements were produced, but not those two statements that showed that the account had actually been closed. And, you know, I need to back up here a little bit too and state that in all fairness, Citibank's current counsel was not the counsel of record as the litigation commenced. It was another counsel. So what we did is we produced, in response to Citibank's discovery request, all statements that Tonet had previously received from the Citibank customer service, including those two statements that showed the account was closed. No investigation had taken place. Also, Citibank was fully aware that Tonet Hoff Schauer claimed that she, that it was her understanding that the Black Hills Federal Credit Union, when they sent off the payoff amount, also sent a letter asking for the account to be closed. Citibank never searched for that letter. In fact, that was something that came up at the hearing. At the deposition, Terry Reining, who was Citibank's corporate designee, stated they never looked for that letter. They knew that allegations had been made that such letter was sent, but in her mind it didn't exist, so they never looked for it. And Judge Delaney said there's a difference between whether that letter exists or whether you look for that letter, and he asked Citibank, following the hearing, to, you know, sign an affidavit or send some sort of verification that that letter had been searched for. Well, ultimately, Citibank did submit an affidavit stating that that letter had been searched for and wasn't found. But during the litigation, while this investigation was supposed to have been going on, while the parties were supposed to evaluate their claims, no effort was made by Citibank to look for that letter. Same thing with those two statements that indicated that the account was closed. We noticed the corporate deposition of Citibank under Rule 30b-6, and we specifically designated as an area of inquiry those two documents, those two statements that were bait stamped as an area of inquiry.
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
How do you respond to the argument that this is an open account of unlimited duration and will remain in effect until such time it's terminated by the actions of one of the parties?
Well, two ways. First of all, for the summary judgment argument that we have on whether or not Mr. Hoff had any permission to activate the account, I think it's irrelevant. The question there is whether or not Mr. Hoff had actual authority, according to the Citibank credit card agreement, to activate the card. Second, with respect to the account, I do agree that the account doesn't expire.
Well, you will admit then it's an open account?
No, in this case, I can't admit that because Tonet Hoff Schauer's statements are that the account was closed.
She, sure, you're right. Saying by her action she terminated, but you will admit that the nature of the account is an open account.
I will, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
Yeah. And if I can just elaborate on that for just a second. But the open account inures to the benefit of the primary cardholder, the account holder. As I read earlier, according to the credit card agreement, secondary card member doesn't have access to the account, only to the account number and the card, which I think is a significant distinction.
What does the evidence show as far as what the, you were talking about this letter and whether or not Citibank searched for it. What was the evidence as to what they did do? Did they pull up the account online and look at all the entries? Which that letter, I assume, would have been entered as information on her account that a customer service rep could see. Did they present that to the judge?
They did.
And this goes to the Baratree claim.
Drafting it. I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure, as I stand here, whether that was presented to the judge, but it was in Terry Reining's Citibank's corporate designee's deposition that they do pull up the screen, they look at the customer service notes. But you know, Your Honor, and this is a question of fact, the customer service notes in this case are not complete. For example, we know of calls that were made to the Tonet Hoff Schauer over which people have testified, for which there is no entry in the customer service record. But I think at the very least, once the Tonet Hoff Schauer brought to Citibank's attention that such a letter was mailed, I think Citibank had, in good faith, had to go search its records, wherever it keeps its records, to determine whether such a letter existed. Similarly, with respect to those two statements, the Hackensack statements, the statements that show that the account actually was closed immediately following the payment, We specifically wanted to inquire as to what those statements mean, what is Citibank's explanation, designated those statements by Bates number. The person that was supposed to talk about these, Terry Reining, Citibank's designee, had never seen them. Had never seen them until the day of the deposition, even though they were in Citibank's possession for 2 years, even though Citibank produced them to Tonette Hoffschauer before litigation had even commenced. And in fact, Terry Reining's deposition statements go a little bit further in saying that she didn't even know that those were, that those existed. She didn't know that anybody could have access to those statements. But I think the way that Citibank has conducted this investigation and the way that it continued in the lawsuit without reinvestigating the facts once those Hackensack statements came to light, I think does show bad faith. And I think if this court decides that Judge Delaney correctly ruled on the paratrain intentional infliction of emotional distress claims, that those that is decisions ought to be affirmed, as well as this grant of summary judgment. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaczynski. Mr. Lang, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Lang, before you get started, I want to make sure I don't miss the chance to ask you this. As a practitioner in this area, can you enlighten us? Frankly, I was somewhat surprised that this has not come up before. Is there something in your research and work in this area that you've seen that makes this particular agreement unique or different, such that we don't have authority around the country for this specific question?
This agreement, the Citibank card agreement, is not unique in its language, is my understanding. I do not know why there has not been any similar case directly on this particular issue. There are some cases that are close. The Drayman case, where a person closed his American Express account, but a travel agent had access to the account number, and the fellow meant to have the travel agent charge a deposit account he had with the agent, and the travel agent instead charged the closed credit card, which triggered a reopening of the credit card. And in that case, which is a Northern District of Illinois case, the court found there to be apparent authority by the travel agent to actually charge that account. But I'm afraid I can't enlighten the court more than that. I'd like to think it's because of the language of TILA is considered preemptive and contemplates the sending of renewal cards, and renewal cards are seen as a security measure or a technology update and not as a cessation of the relationship and a renewal or reactivation of the relationship, but rather a continuation of an open account.
But the problem here is that the secondary card holder reactivated it, or not reactivated it, but activated the card.
Now, I think the problem here actually starts with Hoffschauer, because the card agreement does oblige her to notify Citibank if she intends to revoke or change the authority of David Hoff, which she never did.
Is there evidence that he had activated it in prior years?
It was sent every, I believe it was a renewal card every 2 years was the setup. So the initial cards came in September. And I don't know if I didn't ask or if I just don't remember who testified that they initially activated the card. Indeed, I think not in Citibank's case, but otherwise, this is now done electronically through calling in and passing the security code, and it screens the call is indeed being placed from the residence or the phone number that the card issuer has, and that the card issuer can dial in the last four digits of their social, or the card member, I should say, can pass a security code, be it the last four digits of the social security number or a mother's maiden name. I think this court needs to decide this case based on what the Citibank card agreement says rather than what it doesn't say. Both sides agree that this is not ambiguous. It's clear that the responsibility is on the cardholder, as it must be. to notify the card issuer if there's been a moving from one residence to another, if there's been some occurrence that prompts the card member to want to revoke the authority of the secondary user. And under the closing of the account for the card member to actually notify in writing Citibank of an intent to close the account, none of which occurred. This card agreement doesn't say, for example, that Citibank can put an 800 number on a sticker on the card. That doesn't mean that the card member can claim there's a breach of the card agreement because Citibank's put a sticker with an 800 number on the card. It becomes silly if the card member can claim that there's a breach because there's something that isn't expressly explained in the card. It doesn't deal with security clearances, which vary continually and updated or continually as technology changes. I want to spend just a little time on the Baratree claim. This court should not base its decision on a misunderstanding about these so-called Hackensack statements. What occurred here is after Hofschauer learned that the card had been used, she called customer service on May 18, 1999, and there's an entry in the customer service notes. I'll add the customer service notes. I don't think there's any contention that they're complete. There's some contention that the collection notes, which are the first three pages in the addendum, may be incomplete because they didn't record when they were told that she wasn't home or that she wasn't in the office or whatever. But on the Hackensack statements, these are statements that were generated at her request from Hackensack, New Jersey. They show when the card is in use. In August of 1998, and I'm referring to Exhibit 11, there is a statement that reflects that the card is open and active in August of 98. This is important because the last communication from David Hoff or Hofschauer was in July of 98, where there was a discussion about paying off the account through Black Hills Federal Credit Union. There then is, for September of 98, no account activity. There would be no statement sent to Hofschauer as a consequence. The Hackensack statement is sprinkled with zeros in odd places. This is Exhibit 11. For example, under her address, it shows zero. It could not be mailed to her. It could not be delivered that way. Strangely, for customer service, it's blank. On the real credit card statements, when there is activity, there's a customer service number that appears. Also, on the real credit card statements where there is activity, the payment address of the Lakes, Nevada appears. On the Hackensack statement for the month where there was no activity, there's a Hackensack address. The code that Citibank uses, and this is all in Reining and Neal's deposition, the code that Citibank uses for a closed account is 36. None of these statements show a code of 36 for a closed account. I would add, there's no testimony from anybody that these statements for September of 98 and then for November of 98 indicate a closed account. Nobody has said that. Rather, a Citibank person looked at it and said, I've never seen an account like this. It couldn't have been sent out. It does not indicate closed account. There is a statement for October of 98, which shows the account activity as being a membership fee of zero, and shows the account being open in October of 98. There was no communication between Hofschauer or David Hoff and Citibank between July of 98 and November of 98 when the card was reissued, a renewal card was sent.
Was there any statement that she had in her possession that showed that she was notified that her account was closed?
No.
All the statements that show might arguably show that are things that were produced in discovery.
Actually, they were produced at her request in May of 99 when a customer service person sent a probe to Hackensack to print all statements, and the computer printed out statements for September and November of 98 with all these zeros, even though there was no activity in those statements.
This is after the dispute arose.
Excuse me?
This is after the dispute arose about
Yes.
these charges.
Yes, but before the litigation plans.
Okay.
The Black Hills Federal Credit Union letter, just briefly, as the court knows from the briefing, Black Hills Federal Credit Union sent a check to Citibank in July of 98 to zero out the account at that point. The person who handled that transaction, Carol Lee Zacher for Black Hills Federal Credit Union, had a practice of filling out a form and marking if a payoff letter was sent. She left that blank. She testified she didn't remember sending a payoff letter. David Hoff testified he never saw a payoff letter. Matt Hoff Schauer testified she never saw a payoff letter. Citibank records these letters in the electronic diary, if you will, that's the addendum to the appellant's brief. It's not recorded in that diary. It was searched for by a woman named Cynthia Ramos and not found. I think actually that's a little bit relevant because Tanette Hoff testified she did nothing to close her account when she was first deposed because she thought Black Hills Federal Credit Union was sending a payoff letter and it didn't. Issues of fact abound. Please reverse summary judgment on the complaint that granted on the other claims.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. The court will be in recess till tomorrow morning.